stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today I'm airing the first half of an interview I did with, as I call him, the one and only Austin Pendleton. Austin, who was nominated for a Tony for his direction of Elizabeth Taylor in The Little Foxes on Broadway, who won the Obie and the Drama Desk Award, who is not only a director, but a very well-respected and, by anyone who knows, famous actor, director, playwright, teacher, and inspiration, Austin Pendleton, with a very unique and special life and a very unusual story. If you've never heard of Austin, this is an opportunity to hear from one of the most unusual and well-regarded people in the theater. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the woods. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Self-discovery. It is all about the fact, at least I believe it is a fact, based on my work as a psychotherapist for more than 30 years, I believe it is a fact that even the most well-meaning parents are unable to give all of their children unconditional acceptance for who that child actually is. With the most well-meaning intentions, parents discourage certain aspects of the children that are born to them. This discouragement doesn't come from meanness or malice, although obviously there is, unfortunately, a great deal of neglect, intentional and not, and trauma in the lives of too many children. Even in families where these terrible things do not exist, parents are unable to give their children this acceptance because of their own life experience. What was acceptable in their childhood? What is traditional or acceptable in their culture? What their peer group or their religion dictates? And unfortunately, quite often, children come into families where things which are natural to them are not okay with the family. You remember the old adage, you know, children should be seen and not heard. Well, there are children who are bubbling over with energy and passion and ideas and interests and curiosity and wanting to try out the sound of their voice and new words that they heard. And if they happen to be born into a family where children are supposed to be seen but not heard, this exuberance, this passion, this intrinsic quality is quite often, I'm using the word discouraged, but trampled is perhaps better, because that's how it feels to the child. And when a child has a natural expression, a natural way of being, a natural bent, and that quality, that activity, that behavior, that way of being is not acceptable in the family that it's grown into, in the school that it attends. We've all heard terrible stories about what nuns used to be able to do to kids in Catholic school. But they're not the only ones. Lots of religions have taboos against things that are natural to a lot of children. So, if the child experiences discouragement, rebuke, punishment about something that is natural to him or her, it feels very much as though that has been trampled. It feels very much as though there is something wrong with me. My desire to giggle, my desire to be very quiet and not participate, my desire to read all day, my desire to run around like a wild Indian, my desire to be whatever it is I am, there's something wrong with that, and therefore something wrong with me. And this belief that there is something wrong with me, and I had better not let anyone know about it. Because children cannot afford, literally cannot afford, to lose the good offices of their parents. Parents let children know in no uncertain terms what is expected of them. Surprisingly, some parents encourage, although not necessarily consciously, really wild and sometimes bad behavior from their kids. They can do it in all kinds of ways. But in the end, children are behaving, being who their parents either want or expect them to be. And in the behaving as their parents want or expect them to be, are quite often suppressing qualities that are natural to themselves. You get the delinquent child, the child who's causing all kinds of trouble. Believe it or not, that is subtly encouraged by the parent. And the capacity for self-control, which the child also has, is discouraged. And so the child grows up believing that he or she doesn't have it. Well, this would be bad enough, except that later in life, it is quite often, and I see this in my practice over and over again, precisely the quality, the activity, the ability that we have had to deny, which is what we need to have a satisfying, a happy, a joyous, a natural and easy life. And so much of my private practice as a therapist is about trying to help people recover those aspects which they have had to deny. I say that they have put them undercover, and that what they are demonstrating and what they quite often believe about themselves is their cover story. And I talk about this, the creation of a cover story, the recognition of what is undercover, and the ability to recognize and then to recover some qualities that are undercover. I talk about this at length in my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And you can find the book, you can even buy the book, at thelynnshow.com. That's my website. THELYNNE, don't leave the E out of Lynn, SHOW, thelynnshow.com. And up there you can find the book, you can find the workbook, you can find the audiobook. You can find out about my psychotherapy practice, which is currently all on the telephone, and read the article called Psychotherapy on the Go, which explains it. You can find out pretty much anything you'd like to know about me. And in addition, you can find all of the interviews that I have done. If you've been listening to the show, you know that the other thing I do in my shows is I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And today I am playing the first half of an interview with the, as I have called him every time I talk about him, the one and only Austin Pendleton. Austin Pendleton, who is incredibly well known, regarded, respected within his community of the theater. Austin Pendleton, actor, writer, director, producer, anything that you can do in the theater, Austin has done and probably won an award for. In this interview, you will hear Austin mention Joanna several times and talk about the fact that she was an actor in the plays that he wrote in Yale and how amazing she was. I know Joanna, that is Joanna McClelland Glass, as a playwright. And in fact, several weeks ago, I interviewed Joanna, and you can hear that interview, of course, on my website. It is because of my relationship with Joanna that I had an opportunity to meet and interview Austin. It was at the reading of Joanna's most current play, that is Amsterdam to Budapest, a wonderful play, which starred in the reading Blythe Danner and Mandy Patinkin, among others, and was directed by Austin Pendleton, which was how I got to meet and how I got to interview Austin. And I clicked a few shots of Austin and Blythe after the reading, and you can see one of them on my website, along with a video created by two young men, I assume that they're students of Austin's, who have created a film called The Austin Pendleton Project, an attempt, I believe, to expose Austin to a wider audience. And their video on Indigo, which is an attempt to raise the money to finish the film. Also, you can find that on my website, and you can learn much, much more about Austin than he is willing to say in these interviews. You hear lots and lots of people talk at length about Austin, and most of them very famous, very well known. In fact, I have cut a snippet out of that video, and it is Meryl Streep and Olympia Dukakis talking about Austin Pendleton, the actor, and I'm going to play that in a minute. It's going to precede my interview with Austin. I want to say, if you have never heard of Austin Pendleton, you have certainly seen him in many, 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 many films, including the one he talks about at length in this interview, My Cousin Vinny. So if this, however, is the first time you've heard his name, you're in for a treat. Austin Pendleton is funny, clever, interesting. His story is not a simple story. So I'm not going to talk any more about him because Austin can very well talk. Well, you'll hear why that's amusing later for himself. But before I play the interview, I'm going to play Meryl Streep and Olympia Dukakis talking about him.
The thing about Austin as an actor is that you'll see him in something and it's almost as if there are all these other actors in the play. And then they drop this real guy in the middle of everything.
And it was in him from the beginning, that hunger, that appetite, that desire.
It seems like there's an inevitability to it.
He acts, he teaches, he directs, he writes.
And there's no line between the man and his work.
He just went wherever people will let him play the great parts. That's what he did.
And so now, the one and only Austin Pendleton.
Okay, so I'm here with Austin Pendleton. The one and only Austin Pendleton, who can't even walk down the street without having people stop and say, can I have a picture with you? And so I told Austin that I only interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Mm-hmm. And I know that Austin has made his life with the art of theater. Mm-hmm. In every possible way that you can. No?
Yeah, just about, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I only ask one question.
Uh-huh.
And it is, do you remember, can you pinpoint the first moment, can you remember or pinpoint the first moment in your life when it occurred to you that acting, theater, stories, performance?
Yes, I can.
What is it?
I'm from Warren, Ohio, and my mom had been a professional actress and mm-hmm. director, and she settled in Warren, Ohio with my dad just before World War II. And at the end of World War II, some people in the community of Warren, Ohio came to her and said they wanted to start a community theater, which they did, and which is now called Trumbull New Theater. Trumbull's the name of the county. And this town of Warren is about an hour east of Cleveland. At that time, after the war, it was a thriving industrial town, and these people came to my mom and they said, we understand that you've had a professional experience in the theater and we want to start a community theater, and we're just asking for some advice. So she got immediately involved with that group. And the rehearsals of the first productions, and indeed two of the first productions in performance, but the rehearsals for the first two productions and the rehearsals of a few subsequent productions were held in the evenings, some of them in our living room. And after dinner, people would come over, the actors, and who were like, you know, all of them had the day jobs, the receptionists, people who worked in the factories, on the factory floor, executives, optometrists, you know, who wanted to act.
Community theater.
Yeah, they would come over in the evenings after dinner and a pot of coffee would be made or something, and we would rearrange all the furniture in the living room, and they would rehearse these plays. And I was just, that was it. That's the answer to your question.
How old were you?
Six.
Six.
No, seven.
Mm-hmm.
Seven.
So when you say that was it, it means I was fascinated, I was interested, I was curious, I wanted to do it.
All of the above. I just thought, I mean, we had an okay household. It wasn't, I mean, you know, like every family, there was a turbulence in there somewhere. But it was a nice, alive household to be in. But when those people would come over in the evening, the energy of the place would be just radically transformed.
And you could feel that.
Totally. You'd start feeling it all during the day leading up to it. Like, I can't wait till they get here tonight. And I was, you know, by the time we would actually start the rehearsal, when I was supposed to be in bed, as, you know, as was my brother,
How old was your brother?
I'm the oldest. He's the next one. He's a year and a half younger. England.
So you were 7 and he was 4 and a half?
No, he was like 6.
6?
And I was 7 and a half, yeah, or something like that.
Right.
And our sister would have been about 2 or something like that. But so she would be asleep. But he and I would sneak down and sometimes hide behind furniture and just go watch the rehearsals, which would go until 10 at night or 11 at night or something. And then we were taken sometimes to go up to Cleveland. It was in the days when all the great shows from Broadway would go on tour. And at that time, the place they went to was this theater called the Hannah in Cleveland. And we would go up to Cleveland and see touring companies of Oklahoma or those musicals and plays, you know. And I was just, you know, I was transfixed.
And did your mother know that?
Yes.
How did she know?
Well, because I never talked about anything else. I mean, for one thing, I think. And then, like a few years after that, when I was in school, I would go over to the houses of different people also involved with the community theater and sit on their front porch with them and just grill them about everything they were working on at the theater, which by this point had moved into the heart of town, into a small theater they made above a cheese shop in downtown Warren. And then they finally constructed their own theater, which is out on Youngstown Road, and is still there. And my mom worked with that theater from when it started in the late 1940s until 1988, when she moved to Boston after our father had died. The last thing that she worked on there was in 1988. And she acted there. I once directed her there after it was an adult in the Glass Menagerie.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and then... she acted in a whole lot of plays, but she did a whole lot of directing there.
Okay, so 7, 8, 9, you're captured. Do you know that this is a life's work, or are you just...
No, I knew it.
You knew it. You knew that this was going to be...
There was never... I don't remember there ever being any serious question. I would camouflage it.
How?
I would... People would ask me, what do you want to be? And I would say, oh, a teacher or something. But I knew what I wanted. It sounds so idiotic to be some kid and say, I'm going to be an actor, or I'm going to go into the theater or something like that. So I didn't go around saying that to everybody. But
did your family know?
Or they certainly knew I was interested.
Right.
One thing they did that was great is they never pushed me one way or the other. I knew how much it would mean to my mother.
Oh.
But we never talked about that. But that wasn't the reason I wanted to do it.
Well, but it didn't hurt.
It certainly didn't hurt at all. And in that way, I'm one of the lucky ones, in that the thing your parents, that they wanted for you, happened to be the thing you wanted.
Yes, that is remarkably lucky.
It's very, and it's not like having a wind in your sails.
Yes, but not only is it good fortune, but it has to be extremely rare that what a parent wanted for a child was the theater.
Yeah, exactly. A whole lot of parents have utterly good reasons for not wanting that for their kids.
So it's real interesting. Your mother did want it for you.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was always this, well, as you say, wind in your sails, there was always this underlying you-go guy, right?
Totally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, totally. It's interesting to me that given that, you still had the sense that others would find it odd or silly or frivolous or, you know...
First of all, I was a hopeless... It was before the days of the young character actor. And, I mean, from what you saw in the movies. I mean, in fact, I was in my mid-20s when all that changed in the business, when a young character actor could become an important actor. The absolute most thrilling example of that was when they cast The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman, who we all knew was a brilliant off-Broadway actor, but not the kind of person who would play a role like that in a movie.
Right.
I think it was just about unprecedented.
Wow.
The actors they had been considering for that were people like Robert Redford and stuff like that, who were superb actors, but they're what was thought of as, you know. And suddenly, I think Mike Nichols had this epiphany and did a screen test for Dustin Hoffman, who was as surprised as anybody else. And he got it.
Yeah.
And then that changed everything for quite a while.
Well, okay, wait a second. I want to hear all about this, but I really want to go back to you.
Yeah, so, but that was the reason that I wouldn't go around saying, because I was this geek, I wore glasses when I was a kid and all that. I could hardly speak. I was, you know, had a very big speech problem. I mean, to say I'm going to be an actor was stuff.
Well, wait a minute. You had a speech problem?
Oh, severe. Yeah.
Really?
It's actually immortalized in that movie, the guy who stops on the sidewalk. My cousin Vinny.
Mm-hmm.
And I only did that movie because the director was a friend of mine. I said, I'm not playing this part. He said, yes, you are. I said, no, I'm not. That's it.
Because it was too close to the bone?
Yeah, I'm not going to go back in the worst moments of my adolescence. And besides, I was always afraid that if I did, and this to a certain degree happened, that if I did that, it would sort of, not exactly end my career, but it would.
Oh.
You know. And but he, you know, he came to New York, and this director Jonathan Lynn, a wonder, I'd met him in England. He said, nobody can understand this as well as you. I said, well.
So he knew.
Oh, yeah, everybody knew. And I said, well, I don't care if I'm.
If I'm right for it, right?
The understanding will remain my secret, you know. And the, but he took me to a Greek restaurant, a little Greek restaurant here in Manhattan. A couple of bottles of Ritzina were consumed, a delicious meal. And I said, yes. That's, I think it's a slightly oversimplified version of it, but not by much.
No.
And but that was a problem I'd sufficiently overcome that I could have a career.
Well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
So we have you as this young boy who's captured, passionate, attached, you know, enthralled with a thing which he doesn't really believe he can do because he has this...
I believed I could do it, but I... have no idea. I believed I could do it, but I didn't know why.
No.
I would be in plays in high school.
Really?
Yeah, and stuff like that. And I would somehow get out of it.
You mean when you were on stage?
Yeah.
Like the country singer. There's a country singer who has can't talk, but can sing. I mean, you know, he stutters when he talks, but he...
Yeah, well, that, I mean, yes, I know you mean so, but I can't think of it.
Neither can I.
But anyway, it's different when you sing. Practically anyone who stutters can sing.
Ah.
I mean, it's...
But you were speaking.
Yeah, I was talking. Every once in a while, I'd be in a play, and it would just overwhelm me. And I would get so traumatized by that. This is like when I was in high school. I would get so traumatized by that I would have to act again soon after that to just like you have to get back on
a horse, right.
Horse or a bicycle.
Right. So this was to prove to yourself.
Yeah,
that you could
it was
still.
Good to know that I had that outlet. And then when I would have real trouble in a play, and that would think that outlet was suddenly closed, I would get
it'd be really scary,
really upset.
Yeah.
And then, but then I went to college. I went to Yale. Mm-hmm. I was an undergraduate. I never went to the drama school.
But you must have been very smart.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't get into Yale because...
I went to Yale in large part. I mean, my grades were okay, but in large part because there was a big shift then of how they decided who they took into universities and if you had some resourcefulness, some kind of... And what happened was in the high school years, some friends of mine and I in Ohio, we put together our own little theater group and we did it in the basement of my parents' house.
I see.
And we did ambitious plays. So I think that's what intrigued Yale. I mean, if my grades had been awful.
Right.
Or something, that wouldn't have helped. But that sort of put me over, I was told.
So what was the major?
Oh, English or something. I was in, you know, it didn't matter what the major was. I knew. And also, there were so many subjects I was so bad in that it kind of narrowed the field down. I flunked physics in high school.
Well, so did lots of people. I mean,
no, not that. People flunk chemistry.
Oh, I
but
see.
Not many people
flunk physics.
I never took a chemistry course in my life, but I flunked physics. And the teacher was this really sweet guy, and he called me and he said, look, your flunky physics, and that could keep you from being able to go on to Yale,
exactly,
where I'd already been accepted.
Right.
He said, so you know what? I'm going to give you a C. You don't even remotely deserve a C. He was very sweet. But just always know you flunked high school physics, okay?
The universe owes this guy for you.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have you if not for him.
That's right.
Amazing. Do you remember his name?
I did until just... He was an older man then.
So he's not alive anymore.
Oh, no. He would have died years and years
What ago. A gentleman.
Oh, he was that. He was that in the classroom. He was one of those people. He was a gentle soul.
Yes.
But like every teacher, he had standards.
Yes, right. He didn't want you to think you'd actually gotten away with
it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, gentle is one thing, but, you know... don't ever get near a hydraulic lift, you know. I mean, it's sort of basically what he said. So I went to Yale, and I probably got in all the extracurricular plays. Every single one they did while I was there, I was in. And two of them I wrote the script for, which were the two that I told you. They would have a competition every year that would be from all the undergraduates in the university, if they wanted to write a new musical, mm-hmm, that then would be their spring show.
Right.
And that was the heyday of the American musical theater. It was the years when every year there was either West Side Story or My Fair Lady or Gypsy or Bates Great or something by Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Right.
You know, it was those times. And so I was just obsessed with that. I was obsessed with musical
Well, now
theater.
That's interesting. Uh-huh. You were interested in musical theater. That's not what they were doing in your basement.
No.
I mean, in your living room. They were doing straight plays.
Yeah, we did the Glass Menagerie.
Right. So when did you fall in love with musicals?
Oh, just every year. I was aware of all the musicals. And
do
all
you play?
All I ever wanted for Christmas was the album, some new Broadway musical,
oh,
which I would play until you couldn't play it anymore.
Yeah.
And I was so interested.
Did you sing?
I sing somewhat. I've been in musicals a lot in New York.
And do you play an instrument?
I've been in cabarets in New York, too.
Do you play?
Anything? Not I can play the piano, but I could never do it, like, in front of people. I can work my way through a piece of music.
I understand.
But the...
It's just interesting to me that you got captured by musicals. That surprises me somehow.
Well, it was the golden age of
it. Yeah, right. That's right.
Except for Steve Sondheim, it hasn't been the same.
No, that's right.
There have been some fine shows, but I mean, it was a real art form.
Yes.
You were excited. Even the big flops in those years were so... They were flops because they were just so ambitious. They were so rich. They were so...
Are you thinking of something in particular?
Do you mean the flops?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not, but I could if I thought about it a minute. There were always a few of those.
If something comes to mind, say.
Okay, but like almost every season, there was at least one of the great musicals.
Yeah, right.
Would open, and the form was so exciting. I would pore over the scripts of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals. I mean the great ones. Mm-hmm. You know, just the way that he, Oscar Hammerstein, evolved that form. So everything worked together and everything moved the story forward and the music was inevitable and all. It just was like, thrilled me. So when I got to Yale, I found out, I mean, you couldn't help but find out that there was, you know, every year this competition that the DRAMAT, the extracurricular group, would put out, like any group of undergraduates can submit a musical, and we will pick one and we will do it. The reigning kings of that, when I got there, they were juniors when I was a freshman, were Richard Maltby and David Shire.
David Shire, right.
And their show was the spring musical in my freshman year, and their show was the spring musical in my in the next year, in my next
right.
year, and then they graduated.
Yay.
Well, they were, no, but they, but, I mean, so the first play I was ever in, as an undergraduate of Yale, was directed by Richard Maltby.
Uh-huh.
So we got to be friends. Mm-hmm. And I would want to hang out in the bars at night and just, I would pump him about musical theater. I was obsessed with it.
I was just going to say.
And he had quite a grasp of it. He still does. He had, and he would just, I would think of some script, and he would read it, not of a musical so much, but I'd write a little play, and he'd say, well, yeah, this is okay, but there's no action. It doesn't have an action. I remember one time reading. I said, well, what's an action?
What's an action, right?
He said, that's like saying, what is the nature of God? You can't just say, what is an action? And I'm going to answer it right now. As the judge says about obscenity, I'll know it when I see it.
I see it, right.
But he instilled all that, and he taught me all about the through line of the story and how that's important in any play. But it's really important in a musical because there's so many different elements in a musical that they can all just fall apart.
If you don't have a through line.
If the through line isn't palpably clear every minute. And some friends of mine and I, we got together and we wrote a musical version of the novel. And this was before it had been made into a very popular movie, Tom Jones, the Henry Fielding 18th century.
Right.
It was, and I'd read that in high school. So some friends of mine, everybody was running around saying, let's write musicals, you know. It was that era. So I said, Tom Jones. And we did this adaptation. And it was picked in our junior year as the musical. And it was this smash hit. And of course, what happens when that happens to you, you think, well,
I can do this. Not that hard.
This is what it's like.
Yeah, that's right.
It's always
going to
be like this.
Be like this, right.
Yeah. And,
That's the problem with early success.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, people would stand outside the theater at night and sell tickets for an aggravated price, you know. I mean, it was like that.
Yeah.
People loved it. And we got people to invite people to come up from Broadway to see it. And we were just convinced that
next stop Broadway.
Yeah. That didn't happen.
No.
They would say things like, you got some
time. It's a good start.
Exactly. And that's but among the many good things that came out of that. That's how I first met Joanna Glass. She was in it.
Ah.
And then two of the so Tom Jones won the competition. The show right behind that, the show that placed the next in line, was a show where I guess the drummer didn't like the script that much. I never did read the script, but the music, the composer, they were very excited about. He was a junior. So there were four of us who wrote Tom Jones, two of them graduated just after Tom Jones. So the dramat came and said, we'd like you to write a musical with this composer for this other show. The other remaining person from Tom Jones was a guy who died just a month ago. Peter Bergman?
Mm-hmm. I know who he is. Yeah. I know who he was.
Yeah. So Peter and this other composer named Jim Massengale and I, we decided we would write one for the competition for our senior year. So I sat down with Jim, who I'd met for the first time, and I said, I hear your music was extraordinary for the show that you submitted. He said, yes. He's a fascinating guy. He said, yes, it is. The clear subtext was,
Yeah.
And I said, could I hear some of it? Well, among a lot of other skills he had, he was awesome pianist.
Mm.
He said, okay, I'll play you some stuff. He played me. I fell on the floor.
Wow.
I mean, I've rarely heard music that talented.
Wow.
In all the years since. I mean, for the musical theater. It was a whole other voice. It was a whole other... It was the real, real deal. And I said, okay, Jim. Okay. What would you like to write? He said, just tell me in general what you'd like to write. He said, well, I don't want it to be a piece of shit like Tom Jones. And I love this guy. I love this guy. I mean, imagine. And it didn't even sound hostile.
No, it was just the way it was.
I hate that shit.
Right. It was just the way it was.
I hate that shit like you all wrote. But obviously he didn't loathe the script that I had written, but he didn't think much of it. So I said, okay, what would you like to write? And I think he was intrigued that I was still speaking to him.
To him, yes, right.
And he said, I would like something set in America in the mid-19th century. I have in my ear a kind of music that's a combination, get this, a combination of Stephen Foster and Kurt Vile. I love this person.
That he can even imagine that there's something that we could combine Stephen
Foster
and Kurt Vile.
I said, well, my God, where in Midnight's Egypt, where do you want to set it? He said, all over the country. I said, well, that's peddlers or it's actors.
Right.
He said, yeah. So I said, well, a few years ago, I read a book, a biography of Edwin Booth called Prince of Players, the actor. And I remember the first 60 pages of that biography, which is a wonderful book, by the way, are about when, as a young man, he toured with his dad, who was an actor, who was also alcoholic and, you could say, half insane.
Yeah.
And I remember I was very affected by that when I read. I never thought of adapting it or anything, because it was before I ever thought I would write anything. And I said, let me go look at those first 60 pages of that book again. I think that maybe their story, that father and son, and they traveled all over the country, and it was before the Civil War, at the end of which, of course, the brother of Edwin killed Abraham Lincoln.
Yes, right.
I said, I don't want to get into the whole Abe Lincoln stuff. I just want... He said, go back and look at it. And I read it, and I came apart. It affected me when I was in the 10th grade or the high school. But I just thought, this story... I have no idea why this story affects me so deeply. It wasn't in the form that it happened in the biography really adaptable. You had to take all kinds of licenses, but those people that she caught in her biography, Prince of Players, her name was Eleanor Ruggles. She died just a few years ago, and so we began writing. We had 8 months to write it, to submit it, because I mean I think we all worked on Tom Jones for 2.5 years or something, and it was obviously a very different kind of show we were going to have.
Yeah, it was dark.
Very dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Tom Jones is right.
Tom Jones has real edge to it.
Yeah, but that's not his name.
Because he's a great satiric writer.
Right,
feels,
right,
but,
right.
But it's funny.
But it's funny. It's
just
bright.
Funny,
it's, you know, right.
It's a happy ending.
Right, exactly.
And et cetera and all that. And so we just... And he began to write this music. We reconvened in the fall. And by now we had 6 months of that. And it was like when wildly ambitious musicals were being... Well, one that didn't really succeed, it sort of was a hit, but it didn't really succeed, was the Lerner Lewin Camelot.
Camelot.
Which was... I mean, it wasn't that well received.
Camelot wasn't that well received?
No, it wasn't. But it was palpably ambitious.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Yeah, there was a...
It's one of the best scores ever.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
And there's a yearning in the script for trying to touch some really deep things.
Yeah.
You know,
I loved it.
Yeah, oh yeah, I loved it too. And I was often more affected by things like that than I was by the out-and-out hits of those years, even though a lot of those were magnificent. And the, West Side Story is magnificent.
Yeah, well it is.
Yeah, and right. That was a hit.
Right.
You know, but anyway, we wrote this show, and Jim... He was a track runner, he's a mathematician, and he wrote this music, and he just began turning out this music. Peter Berg, who had this infallible ear for the vernacular of that era, would write the lyrics. As he then proved a few years later in the Fireside Theater, he also had an infallible ear for the era that he was
writing,
which he was writing, but he had this incredible ear for that, and they wrote the, and we worked out this whole new relationship between the songs and the script that at that time was kind of new, and it was being rewritten all the time until opening night. And Joanna had a big part in that, had a large role in it, in which she was astonishingly good. And I would write these long scenes that were very heavy and intense and all that. And Jim, and
not like you.
Oh, good. You're wrong about that. And then Jim and Peter would write these things that were just, as he said, like a combination of Stephen Foster and Kurt Vile, which is haunting and strange.
And strange, right.
And gets to you. And so we put it on. And because we'd never even been able to get through it in a dress rehearsal, because it was always being changed and everything. My fault. And so opening night, we had no idea it was 3.5 hours long. It all seemed to be going very well, and I was at the back of the house, and Peter Bergman was pacing back and forth, and I'm just standing there thinking, this fucking thing is really working. And we're midway through the second of the two acts, which is very dark. And Peter comes up and says, I have bad news for you. And I said, what? He said, it's 11:45. I'll never forget that. I lost all track of time. You know.
But there's nothing intense about you.
And then he just kept on pacing. You know, right. And we had the whole second half of the second act yet to go when he announced right. this information. And it wasn't a disaster. In fact, in a way, it was a bigger success than Tom Jones because it was more unusual. And the fact that it didn't even work at all was, you know. But it didn't work. And again, people came up from New York and essentially said, yeah, but what? So then in the fall, after I moved to New York, I got a letter from the parents of Jim Massengill. He's an only child. Who were I think he had them kind of late in their life, you know. And they were Midwestern folks from Missouri. And they'd come to see the show. And they're very serious. And I got a very sweet note from his mother saying, Jim never wants to collaborate in the theater again.
His mommy had to write to you to tell you that?
He didn't know how to do it. He was afraid to do it. And she said he was very upset by it. And I knew he was upset when we were in rehearsal and all that. And just that whole collaborative thing. And it's not easy.
No, it's
he
not.
He behaved easy. Wonderfully. But it was, I could.
But it was telling on him.
Yeah,
it was costing him.
Yeah.
Right.
And so she said, my husband and I saw the show. We thought we enjoyed much of it. It was written in a plain spoken kind of Midwestern way. We did have difficulties with certain parts of it, but it was a good show. And but I'm writing you to say that if you want to go ahead with the project, that Jim would prefer if you find somebody else.
Right.
So I wrote to Jim and I said, I understand. I'm very sorry. I think you're brilliant. I like you, which I did and do. And all the best.
Yeah.
And I've never seen him or heard from him again. And in fact, when we had our 50th reunion a year ago, I finally got the nerve to look in the yearbook, and he's still there. He's had a brilliant career as a professor of math, like at one of the big universities in California. Mm-hmm. I should email him. It's been 50-some years.
Mm-hmm. Do you still have? Was there a video or an audio of the play?
An album.
There was?
There's an album. It's probably pretty awkward, but you hear in the orchestration what he was doing. It's unusual.
Mm-hmm.
It was very. It haunts me still. So I got two friends here, you know, to work on it, and we worked on it for years. And it almost got on Broadway a number of years. A lot of wonderful actors wanted to play the father, and then they would always fall apart, and then we finally got an out-of-town production of it that didn't really work. And then I said to my two collaborators, can I try to write this as a play? Because, I mean, we'd worked on it for 20 years on and off. You know. And
So did you?
I did, and it was the first play I ever wrote. I started writing it when I turned 50. I thought, it's a birthday play. I'm just going to try to write this as a play. So I did, and Frank Langella played in it.
Ooh.
And we did it at The Father, you know, and we did it at Williamstown and then at Long Wharf, where it was a huge hit. And then we did it in New York, and it's published and all that. I keep working on it, of the three, and I've written two plays since then, and of the three plays, it's the least often produced, but I don't know, it's a crowd pleaser.
Do you want to put music to it again?
No.
No.
Although every once in a while I hear from the composer saying, let's try it again.
I'd like to keep working on it as a play. You know, if the composer, I mean, the composer and I occasionally email each other, and once in a while that comes up. I want to get the script exactly right before we do that. The play, I made huge strides with the script when I turned it into a play, but even then, it betrays its origins. It betrays that it was written, first begun by a very, very young man. And it has some of the excitement of that, but it also has some of the chaos of that.
Yes.
I mean, it's been wildly restructured, but it's stuck in certain original structural choices that are sort of tying it up. And yet, at the times I've made a break completely from those, it kind of loses something. So every once in a while I persuade some theater to put it on. It's been done a few times around the country. Mm-hmm. I tried to persuade Frank to do it again.
Oh, God.
See, Frank said, "Oh, I've done it 3 times. I know. And it's an exhausting role. He's never off the stage. The father who's the madman. And it's never been a disaster with the critics or anything. It just hasn't been embraced the way the other two have.
Well, okay, so back me up now. Mm-hmm. You're in college, mm-hmm. and you're writing these things, mm-hmm. and you think you're going to be, you know, the next best thing, mm-hmm. and then you graduate.
That's right. That's the story of my first 21 years in one very efficient sentence.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And then you, and then
you graduate.
Yeah. Right.
And so?
And so, if you want to hear the rest of the story, which is absolutely fascinating, you had to tune in next week to The Lynn Show, because I'm going to be playing the second half of my interview with Austin at that time. At the beginning of the show, I talked a lot about the unfortunate fact that most parents are unable to unconditionally accept their children for who they are. You can hear in Austin's story that he is one of the lucky ones. When someone can say that my mother was the wind beneath my sails and describe an extraordinarily difficult time dealing with an obstacle like the one Austin had to deal with. To be, as he says, a geeky kid who was wearing glasses and who had a terrible stutter and who had an extraordinarily difficult time as a young boy and as a teenager because of it. To not be able to speak the name of what he was, which he knew from the time he was 7, and that was at the very least an actor. His ability to write, to direct, that would all come later, but his certainty that he was an actor, that he would be an actor, that came with the territory of being Austin. He knew when he saw it what it was, and yet it was the opposite of what he presented himself to be. And so he had to pretend to his friends, to his peers, to his parents' friends, to his teachers, to anyone who asked. He had to deny who he was. But even though he had to deny this passion, this desire, this work that he was going to do, even though he didn't know how he was going to do it, he didn't have to pretend to his family. There really is no way to overestimate the importance of knowing that you have the support, the understanding, the encouragement, the backstop of your family, that they want for you what you want for you, that they believe that you can be who you believe that you are. The remarkable thing about Austin is, well, one of the remarkable things about Austin is that from the moment that he saw it, he knew that it was his. He knew that he was it. And it's so interesting to hear him say, I knew I was going to do it, even though I didn't know how I was going to do it, and that the world didn't really present me with a role model for what I wanted to be, that there were no guys like me who were being successful at it. But that didn't matter. And I believe that a lot of the reason that it didn't matter, that what the world was showing him didn't matter, was because his mother, at least, his family, the people who did matter, knew who he was, believed in him. And so he could believe in himself. So he could pursue this thing which lots of other people, maybe most other people, would have said, are you kidding? And if it were their own dream, would have found a way to bury it deeply under cover. So Austin and his family are role models for how it needs to be done. That the acceptance, self-acceptance, and the acceptance by others is essential to our becoming who we are. And Austin, he became who he is. He, as you heard, Olympia Dukakis say earlier in the show, writer, director, actor, no line between them, because he just is. It is the reason I do this show, so that you can hear what it sounds like when someone just is themselves. And if you are not your whole self, then it is my hope that listening to Austin lets you know that it's possible. That whatever it is you told yourself about why you can't be who you are, or you can't believe what you believe, or you can't act in the way you want to, it's not true. It requires permission. And if you didn't get it from your family, you have to get it from yourself. And that's one of the things that I am hoping I am helping people do. Be able to get permission from themselves to be who they are. So, of course, I'm running out of time, and I need to thank, as always, Josh Hackney, my IT guy who makes this show possible, and everything that I do that has a plug attached to it possible. And if you need help with any of those things, you want Josh Hackney, and you can get him where? At my website, where you can get everything else that has anything to do with me. And as always, I hope you got something from this show that you can use. Something that you didn't know, something that inspired you, something that made you laugh, something that made you think, something that will bring you back so that you can hear the rest of Austin Pendleton's story, because he and I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure, I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated. Oh,